Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Welcome back to Gangland Wire Crime Stories, folks. This is Gary Jenkins, and this is going to be the second part of our Jimmy Duarte show. And our special guest, Bill Owsley, is back here with us again tonight. Don't forget, I know a lot of you already probably have read his books, but tell other people about them. They're great books. If you like Kansas City organized crime, they're the best books that you can buy. Open City will tell the story of the mafia in Kansas City from the turn of the century up until the 50s or so, and then Mobsters in Our Midst will tell it from that time on forward until Bill retired. And he was assigned to the organized crime squad and local FBI office in Kansas City for his entire career, practically. I think he only had one other office that he was assigned to, which is pretty unusual for an agent to be just to have one office and that he, main office that he was assigned to for all those years. But first, as usual, we're down in the deep, dark confines of the Big Dumb Fun Show studios, and we're here with my friend Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Aaron, tell the folks a little bit about your show and your new project again.
The Big Dumb Fun Show is a drive time style trending talk radio, independent unsigned music television program that's live Mondays, 7 to 10 p.m. Central Standard Time. The other project we're doing now is called Sarcasm Cinema, where we get together with myself and three comics usually and make fun of good movies.
All right, well, let's dive right into this. Now, to catch you guys up, if you remember, we were talking about James Salvatore Duarte, who was a mobster, probably not a made guy. What do you think?
No, Bill? I don't think he was.
You know, when they when Bill found the list of people who got a percentage of the skim from Las Vegas, Jimmy Duarte's name was not on it. There were other people who were not directly involved with the skim. They're getting a little piece of the action, and we're pretty sure those were all made men. Would you not agree with that, Bill?
Oh, yeah.
Those
and
were made guys.
And his uncle, Tana Lococo, was still getting money since even though he was in his 90s.
Right, but Jimmy Duarte was not getting any of that money, so I would say he was not a made guy. He would be what we call an associate. Well, how could you describe that for the folks, Bill? What being an organized crime associate, would he have to kick up, if he made some money, did he have to kick upstairs to Corky or Tuffy or somebody?
Well, when you're an associate at the level of Duarte, who had the attachment through his uncle, who was a made man, you were operating almost as a member, only you had never been initiated. You are totally under the umbrella. You must abide by all the rules and regulations. You don't kill somebody without authority. You don't. All the rules apply to you. You may not be a member, but when you're that level of associate that Duarte was, you're totally committed to the family, and you'd be kicking up something or have to get a pass on a certain activity that you could keep.
It would be yours alone.
Yeah, but normally they would expect you to be an earner.
Right. I would imagine this Oklahoma scam that they had going, where they were trying to take over the clubs and establish gambling and prostitution in these clubs and paying off politicians down there and really basically owning the whole county around the Grand Lake. I would imagine that was approved, and probably if they'd have started making money, they would have had to kick some of that back upstairs.
I agree. I agree with that, yeah.
Now, to bring everybody up to date, what Jimmy Duarte and a man named Clifford Bishop and a Cherokee Indian down in Grove, Oklahoma area named Jack Michael King and a local Kansas City man named Nate Brancato all were in a conspiracy to take over the Grand Lake area, shall we say, and that's kind of a broad sweeping statement, but to establish a presence in certain clubs, and they were moving in on one club in particular, the Mr. Yuck Club, owned by a man named Jess Roberts, and they were sucking Jess Roberts in, and he had put $150,000 into this club, and it was a brand new club, and Duarte was moving in on it. They were probably intending on taking it away from him and running it themselves in the end. They had gotten the local district attorney, the local sheriff, the district attorneys. Frank Grayson was a district attorney. A man named Husong was his investigator, and he was on the payroll, and the sheriff was indirectly on the payroll. I don't think the sheriff ever got indicted in this deal. He got a car. He was supposed to get a car from him, but he wasn't
indicted, nor was the dealership.
The dealership, no.
But provided the car.
Yeah, no.
No, they, no. Duarte and the crew rented this car from Feld Auto Leasing up here in Kansas City, a 72 Chevy or something, or whatever it was. And it was delivered by Bishop. He drove it down there. Supposed to go to the sheriff. Handed it over to Husong, the investigator. And then they later learned that Grayson said, "Well, I don't know if the sheriff's going to be reelected. That's coming up. So I think I'll hold the car until we see the outcome of the election."
You got to love the guy. You got to love that guy's greed, yeah. Man.
This is the kind of guy Duarte would be very friendly with.
You know, it's Grayson. He thought he was smarter than everybody. I know old-time detective Ray Kenny, God rest his soul, guy that taught me everything that I know, and Bill and everybody else. He told me, he said, this Grayson, he was working with an IRS agent on this case, and they called Grayson up. The strike force had taken over. The strike force is kind of a new thing at this point in time. We'll have Bill talk about the prosecution here in a minute. But they called Grayson into Kansas City to interview him, and so he came up, and he acted like he was going to be their agent and was going to work for them, and he was in law enforcement, and he was going to help them out, but he said they could see that he was just dirty as anything. Ray tells a story. He and Alan Malcolm was this guy's name. They went down there just to look, and they drove back into an area where he didn't tell me who it was, where one of these guys lived, and there was a bunch of guys at the house, and they saw them sitting down the road and just kind of watching and driving by, and they jumped in a car, and they took off at a high rate of speed, and they felt like they were being chased. And as a matter of fact, Ray was sure they were being chased, and they were on a gravel road, and they had these guys hot on their tail till they got to the highway. And once they got to the highway and on the highway, and there was other people around, they backed off and let them go. So it's kind of you don't usually have those kind of things happen in the intelligence work. They usually don't go after you. And I think they probably did it because they thought they were some other criminals that were probably out there to rob them or something. They'll never mess with the police, but they were cruising
by the police officer's, the sheriff's house.
No, it wasn't the sheriff's house. It was one of these people that were involved with the criminal stuff down there, and I don't even know whose house it was. But anyhow, that's an aside. So, but there was a prosecution. Jess Roberts had been. They tried to kill Jess Roberts. He was backing out. He owned the Mr. Yuck Club, and Duarte and Bishop and King moved in. Were moving in on him, and probably maybe Husong even set him up from one of the things Bill said, because he knew. He was reporting that the guy was dead in the back of a trunk of a car when he actually wasn't dead, and he got out of the car and he'd made his way to get some help by then. And so, of course, Roberts then, I'm not sure, how did he even come to federal law enforcement? He couldn't go to the county sheriff. I guess there was a chief of police down there, or somebody had to take him in. Do you remember anything about that?
Well, the attempted murder had been reported, and certainly had been been an issue at the time that was picked up by law enforcement. And my recollection is, you know, we have an agent down in Miami.
Oh, yeah.
A resident agent out of the Oklahoma City office. And he was a great agent, a guy named Les Ferris. He was wired into everybody. And Les Ferris, I'm sure, heard about knew about the murder.
Sure.
And the surrounding facts came to light. And so the agents went down from here and made an approach on Roberts, and he agreed to testify. He didn't contact us.
Well, when he was shot, somebody picked him up and took him to a hospital.
Right, yeah.
And
yeah.
I would think they would normally report that to the local authorities.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which is a dangerous situation for him.
Well,
yeah,
but, you know, by that time, Roberts didn't have much choice of worrying about his shooting being reported. That was not of concern to him. He was just trying to survive. So he simply agreed to cooperate once he was contacted. But that kind of information was not going to be unheard of down there by various law enforcement people.
Oh, sure. Like this, the resident agent in Miami, he would know people who frequented the club.
Oh, yeah.
He would know the sheriff's deputies. He would know the local policeman in Grove. There's probably some kind of a small police department. He would know all these people. Mm-hmm. He would know people at the hospital. And so somebody would know of his interest in this by now, and they would give him, somebody would give him a call. There's no doubt about
it. Oh, yeah, yeah. And the word got back that these Kansas City guys were down there, and that interested us up here in Kansas City.
Yeah, it was it was really quite a deal. It was like right out of a TV show that, you know, the Kansas City mobsters move into rural Oklahoma and try to take over a county. It's like Walking Tall. You know, they take over a county, they pay off the sheriff and the prosecutor and the prosecutor's investigator. They pretty well got the county wired for a while and do what they want until so Jack Michael King and
till the failed murder,
the botched murder. Yeah.
Well, that ended the whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah. What I read was Jack Michael King and Clifford Bishop got him out at they called it the Cherokee Stomp Grounds. Some kind of, they have stomp dances and they somehow
sounds like another location for your app.
Yeah, really. That's down in Oklahoma. Lured him out there and shot him but didn't get him killed. So so that's where we are. And the strike force is notified that about this case and so Bill, tell a little bit about the makeup of the strike force. And was Mike DeFeo the prosecutor at that time, the head of the strike force?
I think he was. Yes, he was. In the 1970s, as the organized crime program gained steam, and the organized crime division of the Department of Justice started to enhance its operations, they came up with the concept of a group of attorneys that were from the Department of Justice, but would reside in a particular city. There were, I think, 19 strike forces, Kansas City being one of them. So they came here, they moved here, they lived here, they operated separate and apart from the United States Attorney's Office. And their mandate was organized crime prosecutions. That's all they were to do.
In 19 cities.
Approximately 19 cities, all of the cities that had major Cosa Nostra families, New York, Chicago, L.A.,
Milwaukee,
Cleveland,
Dallas,
Cincinnati.
Not Dallas. Dallas didn't have a family, or Cincinnati, Philadelphia, Jersey, those cities, Buffalo,
yeah.
Pittsburgh,
Kansas City.
So we had a strike force here. And these attorneys, and it created some issues across the country. The United States attorney, who was the chief prosecutor for the district, didn't quite like this other group removed from him operating.
Mike DeFeo didn't have to, as a head of the strike force, he was under the local politically appointed U.S. attorney, but not really.
He answered to the Department of Justice, and the trick was to get along with the local United States attorney.
Okay.
I mean, if it came to push came shove, the issue would go back to the attorney general, and then a decision would be made. Fortunately, DeFeo was not only an outstanding attorney, but he was a very diplomatic guy. He was a terrific guy. And he was able to make the very best of the situation here. And we never had a problem. They always included the United States attorney in what they were doing, in the press releases and all of that. So fortunately, we had clear sailing. But these fellas were not politically attached. They had no horse in the race here except to prosecute organized crime.
So as they would bring forth their cases and work on them, it was really completely separate from the attorneys or attorney general for
right.
the district here
right.
or in other cities.
That's right. And they would, of course, include. They would tell the United States attorney what they were doing and keep them as a partner. But they handled everything. And as the United States attorneys became more comfortable, they let them, you know, they had their own head. But these people were absolutely independent of any, they didn't live, I mean, they hadn't been raised here. They didn't have any political agenda, no friends here that...
Their family's not here.
Not family call on them. So, and they were fortunately... all outstanding attorneys. They were really good.
Yeah.
Really good.
They always seemed to be the cream of the crop.
They were. They were.
And, well, while they were independent, they would still have to work like with the local intelligence units.
Oh yeah,
As far as because they were as an individual in a city, that's not a lot of manpower.
That's right. Well, what the idea of the strike force was the second step. First, you have this independent group of attorneys. Then every investigative federal agency that had an investigative arm, labor, IRS, ATF, FBI, agriculture, customs, postal, each of those agencies had to assign a man to the strike force office. And the idea was, if a certain name came up, Jimmy Duarte, the strike force would have the ability to have every federal agency input what they had or what they could do in this particular case. So the idea was to, where we had decompartmentalization, to bring it together and consolidate what everybody could contribute and what they knew. And that was the other brilliant theory behind the strike force.
It's a little bit like what happened after 9/11 when they're saying, you know, people aren't talking to each other. CIA and the FBI aren't talking to each other. Had they been talking to each other, maybe might have stopped that thing. And then maybe even one FBI office might not have talked to another during that time or got something up. And so there was a mandate after 9/11, and they created these joint task force on terrorism. And they include local law enforcement and an agent or a representative from all the different agencies to cut through all that kind of jurisdictional and the CIA brought them in too to cut through all those kinds of problems of
sharing information,
yeah,
or not in the
or
case
not.
Of
yeah.
as
sometimes
it may be.
People don't. I mean,
oh,
people
yeah.
are human
well, but
beings.
In this case, I mean, you're talking about like if you have interstate commerce or you have alcohol involved, and some of these other federal bureaus might have insightful information on activities that another one wouldn't have, like the IRS.
Well, another benefit to this system was the organized crime statutes were fairly limited in the 1970s. We were still catching up. There were a lot of situations we couldn't do anything because we didn't have jurisdiction. Whereas in this particular case, if we had a target, Jimmy Duarte, every agency that had a law could look at Duarte and we may get him on something other than a big racketeering case.
Sure.
So the Strike Force, if you look at their prosecutions, they're across the board. We got them for food stamps. We get them for state taxes they withheld on. Whatever this person...
Mail fraud.
Whatever we could get them on, rather than just saying, well, Jim DeWardi doesn't fit any of the 9 federal statutes, so he's off the board. We had Joe Filato on bad food. They had roaches and crap in their bread, and so we went in on him. So we were after these people as an individual, and by having the auspices and the locals, we could go. The only problem was Jackson County. You know, we could bring a case to the local police department, try to get it through Jackson County in that era. They still were throwbacks to the old days.
Yes.
You know, so I won't mention names of some of those DAs.
There's kind of a stone wall.
Yeah,
there.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was one of the frustrations of the police department and the intelligence unit, because, you know, so anyway.
Okay, you know, now we got a background on the Strike Force. There was a problem in prosecuting this case and a particular judge because of the Strike Force concept. It was a brand new concept, and there was the judge, John Oliver, was assigned to try this conspiracy.
Right.
And there were several different statutes involved, go ahead.
Here in Jackson County.
Federal court.
It's a federal court.
Okay.
Federal district court. We indicted DeWardi. We indicted the 6 guys. DeWardi, Bishop, Brancato, Frank Grayson, Hugh Song, and King were all indicted. Jess Roberts and Olivia Pitts were named as unindicted co-conspirators. That's a system where they were involved, but not enough to get them prosecuted. So they're indicted. It's time to go to trial. Judge Oliver is the judge assigned. Judge Oliver, from the get-go, had been considered an anti-government judge. He was a very liberal guy, very liberal, anti-government. So, and he was not one who was very happy with the Strike Force. In fact, he had said they had no jurisdiction in Kansas City. That was one of the things he tried to do. He tried to run them out of the city. So now they are prosecuting this case. And one of the things that people ask oftentimes, what was some of the most difficult things in prosecuting organized crime? Well, one of them were federal judges like John Oliver and our own government and our own people. So we go to trial. The whole conspiracy is laid out, everything that they did to bring this operation together. And then they tried to kill Jess Roberts as part of the conspiracy. Judge Oliver struck any testimony about the attempted murder as being prejudicial to the defendants. So the fact that these guys shot this guy three times, put him in the trunk of a car, drove him out further, dumped him in a ditch, and left him for dead was too prejudicial in his eyes, which was...
To bring into the case.
So the jury doesn't hear this. Jury doesn't hear anything.
But they were never charged with any of the attempted murder?
They couldn't. They couldn't be charged with the murder. How did that work now?
And I didn't charge him locally with the attempt murder either.
Happened in Oklahoma, but it's a federal court.
Of course, they're probably not a federal
And the guy's
crime.
Alive, so he's going to testify, these are the guys I met.
Okay.
They called me. They shot me.
Well, here's what happened. They indicted him and named it in the conspiracy, but when it came to trial time,
mm-hmm.
Judge Oliver denied the government the right to enter that evidence.
Sure.
Even though it was in the indictment. He can do that because this is the trial.
Yeah.
The indictment is one thing. That's the charge. But when it comes to evidence, so he did not allow any of that in the trial, which I mean, it just blows my mind because it's a very important part of the conspiracy. So that was the first thing that Oliver did. Then, now they're all convicted by the trial jury. They're all convicted. Now, what Oliver does is he releases these people who have attempted to murder a guy in furtherance of a conspiracy, have accepted bribes and what have you. Normally, defendants like this, they go to jail pending their appeal.
Mm-hmm.
They don't give them an appeal bond. So he lets them out on the street pending an appeal. The appeal that takes over a year and 6 months, they're free on the street. So during that period, Duarte's committing crimes. Beside that, during the time of this conspiracy in October of 72, while the conspiracy's going on, Bishop is federally convicted of interstate transportation of forged documents, and he's put on probation. So while he is conspiring in Oklahoma, he's on federal probation. Does Judge Oliver consider that? No. The only reason he couldn't allow Bishop out is because we got his probation revoked as a result of this case. So he was in jail. The other defendants, after the conviction, he lets them out pending appeal. Now, the appeal takes a year and a half. After the year and a half, then he says, I'm going to give them a 90-day study before I sentence them. So they go to jail for 90 days. In 90 days, they come back, and Judge Oliver says, release these people pending final sentence, and there is no date for final sentence. So it could be 10 years, could be 5 years, who knows? So he releases them on the street again. Now, in the interim, the strike force files a enhancement of sentence under the Organized Crime Act of 1970. It allowed in organized crime cases for sentences to be enhanced up to 25 years. So they get permission from the department to file a motion for enhanced sentencing, and they recommend 10 years for Bishop and Duarte and 6 years for all the others.
Pending that the judge actually has a sentencing date.
This is going to be part of sentencing. Yeah, if he ever sentences him. Well, another year goes by or something like that. I forget the exact days. But these guys are on the street. They're on the street operating, doing whatever they're doing. And finally, at sentencing, the judge denies the government motion. He discards all the information that was part of the motion as to the organized crime activity, the murder, attempted murder, the bribery, the whole thing, all of the nasty business. He discounts it all, denies the motion, said, I'm not going to apply that enhanced sentencing. And he gave them all 2 years. 2 years.
For the conspiracy to
introduce gambling, prostitution, and bribery into Grove, Oklahoma.
2 years.
And an attempted murder.
And an attempted murder.
Which he discounted and didn't allow in the trial.
Did anybody ever consider that maybe the mob had their hooks into Judge Oliver?
No, they didn't. He was just...
He
was just trying to show the strike force he was boss.
That's right. He was an impediment in the organized crime program that we're trying to prosecute these people. And then
that's what he has the right as a judge to sentence him, and he could sentence him to 90 days.
He can send him to anything.
Yeah.
You know. And then at the sentencing hearing, the prosecutor asked to make a statement. He said, you're making no statement here. Put it in writing and file it with the clerk, which meant it went into the round file.
Yeah. I noticed in your book you said that they got this 2-year sentence, and And during this time, Cliff Bishop had done a burglary of a Macy's store in Kansas City in Jackson County, and he got 3 years for that.
Well,
and that was going on while he was on parole. And they would catch, I mean, because while these guys were out, since they were known associates, wasn't there some sort of intelligence activity following them to see, you know, because obviously once they're back out on the street, they're going to go back to what they know best.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's how we got Bishop violated. I mean, as this case developed, he got violated. And when these guys are on the street, we're certainly going to follow their activities, you know. But they also realize they're under sentencing. They're going to be a little careful.
And his burglary, he burglarized a Macy's. Guy like that, he just didn't break in there to steal a leather coat or two. I'm sure this was a big-time burglary.
But, I mean, Bishop was on parole, federal parole, while he's conspiring to introduce the conspiracy and while he commits an attempted murder. Shotguns Bishop, robs three times. And he's on parole. And to Oliver, this means nothing. Means nothing. He got 2 years.
It's kind of topical today because, you know, there's there. In the meantime, because of crack cocaine mainly and narcotics, they passed the sentencing guidelines, which have these real draconian sentences. I used to say you can make a snitch out of anybody if they're looking at 50 years.
Oh, yeah.
They're 25, 30-years old drug dealer, and they're looking at 50 years, and they get, you know, you get sentenced under one of these drug laws, crack cocaine laws, you're looking at 50 years, and there's no, a judge has no leeway today. They have no leeway. Now, they're looking at rolling some of that back, I've noticed. The pendulum swings back and forth, doesn't it, Bill? Seen the pendulum swing back and forth, so it's interesting.
Well, the idea, just one quick thing, the idea behind enhanced sentencing was the conclusion that everybody drew and knew, you don't rehabilitate a Cosa Nostra guy, a mob guy. So put him in jail and warehouse him, because you're not going to change him. You're not going to rehabilitate him.
Interesting. Okay, well, I think that's about the end of this evening. You have heard the story of Jimmy Duarte and the conspiracy to the La Cosa Nostra conspiracy to take over a whole county and a whole area in northeastern Oklahoma, and how they got arrested and how their hands got slapped basically at the end. But, you know, Jimmy Duarte ends up getting in another trouble. Maybe we'll come back and talk about him some other day.
Bishop, he gets in trouble.
Bishop, he gets another
trouble.
So
he ends up being 3 more years.
Yeah, he got that, but he got in a lot more trouble after that. They got in trouble for bringing explosives back to Kansas City and blowing up a bar and insurance fraud and a variety of things. And Jimmy, you know, Jimmy came back out after that. He got several years on conspiracy to transport explosives into Kansas City, and he came back out of jail after that and died a natural death in a retirement home, old folks home. I was around when he sold his house and moved to an old folks home. Matter of fact, a friend of mine in the intelligence unit went by. They had an estate sale at the house, and he went to Jimmy Duarte's house, and there was a book. The book was, God, it was the one Jimmy Fratiano did. What was the name of that? God, it was real well known at the time.
The Last Mafioso?
Last Mafioso by Jimmy Fratiano. And he was a high-level guy. He wasn't exactly the boss of a family, but he was a pretty high-level guy.
Jimmy writing a book.
He went in the witness protection program, and he really, he ratted people out and testified all over the country. He really put a hurt on some people. And he wrote a book, and so Gary Wantland was this guy's name. He was in the intelligence unit at the time. He's now deceased. He died at an early age of cancer, but he was a good officer. He was a really good undercover guy and good investigator. And so he went in the estate sale, and he found that book was for sale for like 25 cents. So he bought it. Jimmy Duarte had the Last Mafioso book, and that would be Jimmy, wouldn't it? I think he liked being a mafioso. He liked that reputation, that kind of, hey, you know, I'm a big-time guy, I'm a big-time criminal, and I'm connected and all that. I think he really liked that. Said he found some underlines in there and notes in the
book.
In the actual book that said this didn't happen. Not true. Anyhow, okay.
Now, Bill has got some books as well.
Oh, yeah. Bill has, don't forget, Open City and Mobsters in Our Midst. Just Google those and you'll find them. I promise you, you'll find them. And if you have any trouble finding them, get a hold of me through ganglandwire.com, and I'll put you in touch with him. I'll get a hold of Bill, and we'll get your name and address and get you one of those books.
We'll send you a book.
Put a link up on your website.
Yeah.
Well, to his Amazon.
I think I do. I think I did that a long time ago. I probably ought to double check that in my blog. I've been blogging.
But when you do the podcast and put that up.
When I do that, I'll do the link. I will do that.
And also remind everybody that you have an app.
I have an app.
And you've added another address to it.
What was it, Bill? 1205 East 85th
Street.
And if you're from Kansas City, you know where BB's Lawnside Barbecue is. That's for sure. So last little nod to my... little public service announcement to my favorite nonprofit, First Call of Kansas City. If you have a friend, relative, employee, someone that you care about that has a problem with addiction, why call, make First Call your first call. 816-361-5900 or go to www.firstcallkc.com or just go to your Facebook page and type in the words First Call KC. Or First Call Kansas City, you'll find it. They got some good people out there and good programs. So I think that's all for this evening. I appreciate you all listening in. And another thing, I didn't ask for any money last time. Didn't ask for a donation. We've gotten a few donations, but I have a donate button. We got to pay for studio time, and I put out some Freedom of Information Act requests, and you got to pay a little bit of money for them. And if you feel so inclined and you like what we're doing, do two things: go to iTunes and subscribe and give me a review. That helps me move up and helps more people find it. And repost my Facebook pages if I talk about it, or retweet if I talk about the podcast. We want to get the word out there. And you can go to the you can go to the shop page and donate any amount of money you want. Now, if you donate $25 or more, I will send you a Gangland Wire T-shirt or a movie. Or maybe even both. So I appreciate you listening in, and I think that's all. Good night, Aaron.
Good night, Gary.
Good night, Bill.
Good night. Thank you very much.
Thank you.